Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Addiction Unlimited podcast, where you get to learn everything you want to know about addiction and recovery. I'm your host, Angela Pugh, co-founder of Kansas City Recovery, life coach, and recovering alcoholic. To learn more about me, you can listen to episode zero on your podcast app or find us on the web at addictionunlimited.com. Hello, my friends. Welcome to episode number 131 of the Addiction Unlimited podcast. I'm your coach, Angela Pugh. Thank you for hanging out with me today and spending some time listening to the pod. I love it when we get to hang out. Hopefully you're doing something fun with your day while you're listening. Today, we're going to get into some struggles of quarantine. And one of my really good friends, Preston Moore, is the host of the High Cost of Anonymity podcast. Preston's fantastic. He's been sober a long time. He's got great insights. He's drug addict, alcoholic, all the good things. And we were talking, I don't know, a couple of months ago, we were having some conversation on the phone, and he was talking about just how he has really struggled during quarantine. And you guys know, you hear me talk all the time about being an introvert, right? So quarantine didn't bother me so much at first. You know, it took a while for me to start to get irritated by it because I am an introvert and I'm kind of, you know, a crazy little mad scientist always at home, buried in my computer doing podcast stuff and social media and marketing and building my businesses and all that stuff, right? So quarantine to me didn't feel much different from my regular life. And I did finally start to get irritated and just missing some of those regular life things. So I really appreciated when Preston and I were talking and he is like, dude, I was just having a really hard time. And I asked him to come on and do this show with me to talk about exactly this thing and the struggles where struggling doesn't always look like a relapse or craving a drink or wanting to go back to that life, right? Struggling can also be being in a crappy mood, not handling things well, right? Getting worn down so that I don't cope with things very well. When my stress level goes up and I'm not doing things to manage that and keep myself healthy, all my behaviors can really just go down the tubes quick. And that's a lot of what we were talking about. And I just appreciate this conversation. I think you guys are going to love Preston. I was on his podcast a long time ago. Again, it's The High Cost of Anonymity. And this is my good friend, Preston Moore. Preston, thank you so much for coming on and doing the show with me. It's such a pleasure to have you on here.
Well, thank you for having me on. You were one of the first recovery podcasts that I ever listened to. So until we started talking regularly, shall we say, I was fanboying out a little bit, like you were this big time celebrity.
That's so funny. Every time people, like when people work with me in coaching or get consultations, that's like the first few minutes of conversation is like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm talking to you. And you know, when it's you, you're just like, whatever, I'm so lame, you know?
That's right.
Like, I promise you, there's nothing impressive over here.
and this is, for the listeners, this is why it's so important to eavesdrop on these really intimate conversations, because we both realize how much we don't have our stuff together and how we have our computers balanced and our lighting sucks and we don't really know what we're doing. It just looks that way. So it's always good to know that not everybody else has their stuff together like I think they do.
I'm an excellent faker. You know what? I'm glad that you said that though, because this is a huge thing. And one of the reasons that I try to always speak pretty openly about any of my struggles, right? Like whatever it is. And that's one of the things that I spoke to you about that I wanted to talk about today. And when I invited you to come on, because I want to talk about some of the struggles that we've all had in this time of coronavirus and quarantine, when we've had just a ridiculous set of circumstances to deal with that none of us could foresee. And
especially people with addiction, we all have some level of anxiety, depression, ADD. We all have some of those things. And I think it's just been so challenging right now. And it's easy to look at pictures and our videos and all this stuff for those of us that are public people. And you do get this idea that, oh my gosh, these other people really have their shit together. And that can make you feel like you're an even bigger mess, you know?
Yeah.
So I try to speak pretty openly about all of that stuff because I never want anybody to think that I've got it all together because I can put together a video and have pretty makeup or something. You know what I'm saying? Because the truth of it is, when I eke out a video, I probably had to build up to it for 2 weeks and probably talked myself out of it 4 days in a row because I didn't really want to do it. And yeah, so that's everything I want to talk about today. And I'm so glad that you said it like that because that is, I think one of the struggles of social media, especially, is you can present an appearance that isn't always super accurate.
I think that's important to point out and important to remember is a lot of times we want to blame social media for this, like highlight real life, but this stuff has been going on since the beginning of time. I'm from the South and the Bible Belt. And so I would joke that the church was like the first form of hair done, shirt tucked in, clothes starched. I don't care that, you know, mom or dad just got in a big blow up fight or I got arrested the night before. You show up as if you got it together. Mm-hmm. And how many times do so many people like to crash and burn, like these people that are exalted into perfection, whether it's politically or social media or celebrities, and then to find out they come crashing down, there's a high cost to having this kind of really pretty well put together image, because then you can't really, you know, divert from it. Thinking in terms of like the, like celebrities, like big time people. But I feel like, you know, 12-step recovery, being in the rooms so often was a really important thing for me. Probably on a little bit of a less of a deep scale, but my dad was a newspaper publisher and wrote more or less a gossip column, and he knew everybody in town. My mom was a hairstylist, so we always knew what was going on behind the scenes. And so there was this line between make sure you present well when you're out in public and then the chatter behind the scenes. I made connections early on that, like, you know, these big time lawyers and doctors and politicians in our town, well, they got some dirt going on. So I feel like that's why I'm so grateful to meetings, to more intimate relationships, like people that you call and talk to on a consistent basis. That's the whole premise of my podcast, The High Cost of Anonymity, that there is a very high cost to not learning to share your story or not having an outlet to tell people I'm stressed, I'm anxious, I'm failing as a father or a husband or whatever. And if I hear you talk about your struggles, I don't feel so abnormal. I don't feel so, it just takes the pressure off. And I feel like those people in 12-step recovery or who are able to build some sort of tribe or community, you kind of got a cheat code if you use it, because consistently when I'm hearing people share kind of behind the scenes and I'm able to share behind the scenes, the pressure, the anxiety, the mental health and the relapse or the going down the rabbit hole doesn't build up quite as much. And I think it's all interrelated, that if I hear you share, gives me permission to share and we create community and I have a better shot of moving in the direction that I want to go, as opposed to, you know, painting myself into a corner.
Yeah.
I'm glad you brought that up.
Well, there's an important part of the honesty of it too, because it is important to share our stories, but it's important to share all of the story.
You know? Yeah, that's true. And as you will, and I know you've got a really great community that's at all different, you know, levels of personal development or recovery, is when I got sober, I did not know how to live my life. I thought I did. And that's probably part of the reason I've struggled quite a bit with COVID is, you would think with 19 years sober that I would have it figured out. you would think that I do not back myself into a corner where the only way out is to use some people, place, things, whatever. You would think that because I know so much that I could self-knowledge my way through situations. And I not only had to be taught, but I have to be reminded on a daily basis. I just interviewed my sponsor on my very first sponsor on my last podcast episode. And he would always say, you're not a slow learner, you're a fast forgetter. And that's why I give you the same things to do over and over and over and over again, because I just don't, at any given moment, with all the tools, all the clean time, all the knowledge in the world, I will be in a corner, crawling out of my skin. And the way that looks today, because I don't have drugs and alcohol, I don't reach for drugs and alcohol as quickly as I used to, it comes out with like anxiety, depression, uneasiness, loss of sleep, on edge with my wife, not being kind, and left unchecked, I'll act a fool. And sure, everybody on Facebook thinks I got it together.
Yes, that's right. Okay, so talk to me about quarantine as an extrovert, because I am an introvert. So quarantine has been a little different experience for me, and probably not so bothersome.
Right. I am as extreme of an extrovert as you can get. I think me and my wife took some personality profile, and on the, it was like four squares. And on the square, the extrovert square, I was as far, I almost went off the page, basically. And I did not really know, I guess I knew that, but I just didn't know how much I got from being around people. Some people, they get energy from other people. They get energy from being in crowds and groups. Some people just get totally drained. I know you've shared a bit about that, you know, being an introvert. My wife is much more like that. She can do people. She can do some extroverted things, but it's very draining. Since I was 18 years old, I worked on the road. So I was a real estate agent for 10 years. I've been in outside sales for years. I do outreach for a mental health and addiction hospital. So I'm always on the road. And when I'm on the road, I make phone calls. So I've got like a list of favorites. It started with my sponsor. When we go to conferences and meetings and go out of town, he'd make me go get phone numbers. And I thought that was the assignment, just get the phone numbers. And I kind of like, you know, got a huge knot in my gut when he goes, okay, now you've got to call five people a day. And I'm like, oh my God, this is crazy. But what that did was I got in this habit of just banging out these phone calls. Like making phone calls to me is like nothing. It's great. But when COVID happened, had to work from home. My wife and kid were here. I was still making phone calls and still making meetings, but slowly but surely over time, the meetings dropped off. It's the summer month, so it stays light longer. So I'd stay out with my son, and I'm like, I don't need to make the meeting. Before you know it, I'm losing sleep. I've never really identified with anxiety, but like I was super inefficient at work. I didn't know what was going on. And I started tracking back. Meetings had been gone. I haven't been making phone calls for 6 weeks. I was trying to think myself through a lot of things because I think I know so much. And like I said, I've never tested so high on anxiety and depression scales that, I mean, Angela, I'm talking, I was desperate. Like I started taking all these doing breathing exercises, taking all these supplements. I committed to doing 30 meetings in 30 days, which ended up being a lifesaver, one of the benefits of Zoom 24/7, and really just reconnecting. And it's kind of pulled myself out of it quite a bit, but I'm still struggling. I mean, I'm not 100% back on the beam, and it's been challenging for me. So
did you deal with some of those extenuating circumstances? Like, did you lose a job, anything like that when quarantine happened or when coronavirus happened?
I was real lucky for the first time in my entire life, I actually work on salary, and I took quite a bit of pay cut and I was grateful. I mean, to be 18 years of my life, I was on straight commission. And so that was That was really beneficial. But probably another thing is about a year, maybe even a year and a half ago, I started down this path of working through my childhood trauma work. I've been attending ACA meetings, adult children of alcoholic and dysfunction meetings. I've been doing EMDR work with a therapist, which I've never done before. And so that was very similar to when I got like really early in sobriety is I knew I wanted to make a change. I knew I wanted to, you know, venture into this personal development world and get better, be a better human, a man, you know, et cetera. But once you start peeling back those layers, it gets worse before it gets better a lot of times. And so that's why a lot of people, when they try to quit, they quit for a while. They're on a bit of a pink cloud. They end up getting so miserable when they start using again. They were worse than they were when they stopped. They go in to get help. Their emotions are all over the place. So they feel worse than they were when they started. So they'd rather settle for like this kind of mediocrity, numbing or kind of metaphorically like just a mediocre life because it's safe and comfortable, as opposed to kind of take a few steps back to go forward. It's some of the hardest work I've done. It's big boy stuff. So
yeah, I did EMDR for the first time last year. And yeah. I knew at some point I would have to do some trauma work, like for sure. And I finally felt like I was in a place that I was strong enough. I was able to deal with whatever. I mean, I don't have any big T major trauma, but I have a lifetime of little T traumas, you know, and trauma is accumulative. So I knew at some point I would have to face it. And I think especially as a business person, I kind of got to this place that I understood some of the side effects of trauma were holding me back in business also. Yeah. And I was just at this really beautiful place in every area of my life. And I was like, okay, I don't want to stall out here. I want to keep going. I want to keep growing. So I was like, this is probably a good time to do some trauma work and really get into that stuff. Now, here's a crazy thing. There should be some sort of warning. Like, I feel like my therapist did not tell me.
Come on, are you about to blame your therapist for that tough work you had to do, Angela?
No. I love that. No, but I feel like when you start digging around in your brain, there are a number of things that can happen, just a physical response to digging around in there and all the things you're uncovering. And not consciously, right? Not like I went in and sat down and did an EMDR session and, you know, ripped open this wound and I was so depressed and couldn't stop thinking about it. Not that at all.
No.
But one day I left an EMDR session and literally went home and I slept like 24 hours.
Yeah.
I feel
it's
like
all,
that
it's all
needs
subconscious
to be,
work.
Right. But that needs to be a conversation when you're starting this work. You know, when you're sitting down, like that's where I feel like my therapist didn't tell me like, hey, you might want to be mindful on days you have appointments. You might want to not have a full day. This or this could happen. We don't ever know what's really going to happen. I felt like I was kind of blindsided. Like I had no idea that all these different, you know, sort of side effects could happen as a result of doing that work.
Well, I kind of had, I wouldn't say the opposite experience, but a lot of people told me that. They said, be careful. You know, I'm telling people that I work for, hey, I'm going to do EMDR. Hey, I'm going to go to ACA. I'm doing all this childhood stuff. And they're like, be careful. But for me, because I think I know so much, Angela, I've been sober a long time, Angela. I've helped so many people. Angela, I've done that stuff. I've done the work.
Right.
Bring it on. The more the barrier, the more the merrier, right? And I just paid no mind to any of it. I thought I was exempt. I thought that because I'd worked the steps numerous times, because I'd taken so many people through the steps, because I have a relationship with the power greater than myself, because I've done a lot of heavy lifting, I thought I was exempt. Now, it's funny to say, but like, I don't know that even anybody could really prepare me. Because you know what's interesting, at least for me, is it's not these big, severe, kind of like what you said, it's not big, severe things. It's like this, I call it like when my defects spurt out the side, right? It's mm-hmm. like an uncontrolled thing when I go, why am I doing that? Or what just happened? Or why do I got this knot in the pit of my gut? It's slowly over a period of time. And the healing is slowly over a period of time, but also kind of like that feeling those shifts internally is slowly over a period of time. And so plenty of people told me, I just didn't listen. So, you know, I think I'm so skilled that things don't apply to me, but yeah, I know what you're talking about. It's tough.
I had no idea that you were that gifted.
That I'm so gifted, just ask me and I'll tell you how gifted I am.
That you're so gifted that all that regular people stuff doesn't apply to you.
That's right. It's just like I was a great parent until I had kids, and I was an amazing husband until I got married. I mean, I think I know so damn much.
Oh yeah. Isn't that fantastic?
That also goes back to why it's so important that I have a community around me and sponsorship and mentorship and people that just, you know, that I can check in with, or that, I hate saying call me on my bullshit, but just know me at a deep and intimate level, because, you know, it's tongue in cheek, but left to my own devices, I think I got it figured out. I think I know what to do. I think I got it all under control. I think that these little things that just seem so insignificant, like, I know I'm numbing out with Netflix, but who cares? Or like, I know I'm going to skip meditation this morning, but I've been doing meditation every day for the last year. Like, who cares? And it's those little decisions. It's like that little chink, and then I get off path, and 6 months later is when I suffer the consequences.
Yeah, and that's so, exactly right.
Yeah, and so it's just like, I was thinking about this. Someone had mentioned to me recently, they're like, do you still go to those meetings? Wow, I'm surprised. You know, you got all this time to recover. Like, why do you still do that thing? And I feel like I need to defend it or whatever the case may be. But I think that is a, number one, it's just an example of how people don't totally understand mental health, addiction, and personal mm-hmm. development stuff. That kind of, once you start, it's a lifelong deal. But you would never walk up to someone that's in their 60s or 70s or whatever, that's super healthy and they eat well and they work out. You would never walk up and go, you know, Angela, you've been healthy for the last 40 years. Why are you still doing that? Like, what? You're still working out? Why are you still eating salad? Like, this is ridiculous. You should have figured it out by now. And that sounds preposterous, but it's the same thing around personal development, mental health, addiction work is, you know, no matter how much time I get, need consistent check-in with people. And the more I start to kind of hide or not share or to keep things back, that's when those little, you know, those pebbles go into the backpack. You know, for me, it's always been a situation where the big challenges, someone dying, having a baby, getting married, getting let go from a job, like those are easy. They're big boulders. They're easy to navigate. You're going, all right, everybody, you know, batten down the hatches. We got a crisis. What's scary to me are those little pebbles that are in the trail that I don't see, that I slip on, or the pebbles that I throw in my backpack before I know, I go, when the hell did this get so heavy? That's those little bitty life decisions that build up for me. And for you, people like you and I, if you suffer from the disease of addiction, falling off the wagon is life-threatening. If a normal person who's not allergic to drugs and alcohol, or maybe who's watching their eating, if they slip off the wagon and binge with birthday cake, I mean, who cares? But for us to fall off the wagon and drink or use, I mean, we could die, or we could end up in a situation where we're, you know, locked up or in a mental institution. So the repercussions for people like us is severe. It's serious, and we can't, you know, you can't really, yeah, you can't take it lightly. And it's just important to stay connected and build community. That's all.
One of the things that I always loved about meetings is it made my commitment something tangible. So I could always gauge my commitment level by my meeting attendance, which was really good for me, right? Because I could see that was just something I could use to see if I was starting to slip, right? If I'm going to, like, I don't think they said do 90 meetings in 90 days. Honestly, I don't think I missed a meeting for 5 years. Like, I was,
yeah, me neither.
I was not messing around. There was no way I was getting away from it because that's where my commitment was. My recovery was my number one priority, no matter what. And later, you know, when I wasn't going to 7 meetings a week or multiple meetings in a day, it was just a way that I could still gauge my level of commitment and make sure that I was still being healthy, you know, because when I start talking myself out of going to meetings or talking myself out of doing whatever other things I do for my recovery, that's a slippery slope.
Yeah.
Just like everything else, right? If I get up one day and start talking myself out of going to the gym, I can't fall for that either. Because if I skip one time, I'm more apt to skip a second time. And then it's 2 weeks later, I'm like, oh crap, I haven't been to a meeting or I've been to the gym, whatever the thing is. So I like having that thing that is kind of tangible where I can see, really gauge where my commitment is and hold myself accountable that I'm not slipping.
Yeah. I was very similar. And what was interesting about meetings early on is it started out, there was a pretty good motivator of fear as a motivation, like fear of falling off the wagon, fear of losing my clean time, fear of, you know, whatever the case may be. And what started out as a, you have to go, became a, I want to go. Like that became what I wanted to do. I didn't want to do anything else on a Friday, Saturday, Sunday night, which I thought was so lame, but go to a meeting and go out for coffee and pancakes after. That's all I wanted to do. It was the best thing ever. And you're right. I mean, it was I just think of how serene and happy and emotionally balanced I was early in my recovery because I was just so plugged in. It's when I started experiencing the residue of life, right? The residue of recovery, shall we say, which is like getting better jobs, getting in more serious relationships. So I go, hey, you know, and it's good. But that's where a lot of these old timers talk about that the longer I stay sober, the narrower the path gets. Like it is so much more important for me to stay on the path because number one, I got a lot to lose, but it was so much easier, Angela, when I was going to meetings every day. Now I can't do that now. Maybe I could, I guess if I was desperate, if it was, you know, you're going to lose your family or else, but you know, it's, it was so much easier when I was doing that.
No, I totally agree. I was the same way. And because then too, you know, my closest friends were all there too. So I looked forward to going to the meetings,
100%.
Connecting with my friends, just like you're saying, going out to dinner afterwards or going to a movie afterwards or whatever. Like it was a blast. Yeah. And there's so often I miss the simplicity of my early sobriety because had that sort of number one priority. And that was the thing that I focused on so much. And it was so simple, you know, it was so easy to just go and show up. And I was so involved, just like you're saying, I was so plugged in to my home group and we did workshops all the time and speaker meetings and events and service work. Like it was so much fun.
Yeah. I think there's this common theme that I'm sure there's a workshop or a speech in here somewhere, but whether it's sobriety, mental health, working out, food, discipline is, I think that the solution is so much higher higher level commitment. In other words, the solution to most things is you've got to have a high level of commitment, high face-to-face contact or check-in with people, mm-hmm. like some early on, multiple times a day. Then maybe you cut back to like once a day or once, every other. I was just having a conversation with someone about this young lady. She was 18, struggling. She tried to get her in to see a counselor, et cetera. But when you think about it, if someone's struggling with mental health or addiction, they're struggling in their marriage or they're struggling in their business, you're telling me your solution is to meet with someone for 45 minutes to an hour a week. And then, don't forget, life might come up and you might cancel. Like, that's the solution and how we're going to save our marriage or get better or save my life. You're telling me an hour a week, Angela?
It's so true. Listen, this is why I don't encourage, like, in all the services I offer in coaching, right? I do one-on-one individual sessions.
Yeah.
I don't ever really encourage people to purchase one session because you're so limited in what you can accomplish in one session. Like, you're not helping someone get sober in one session. It's just not possible. So I always say, like, one session is a fantastic thing if you have like a specific event and you want to troubleshoot it and make some plans and prepare and make sure you have things in place to protect your sobriety.
Yeah.
That's great for a single session. But when you're talking about really getting your life together and getting sober and figuring out how to do that on a daily basis, meeting with somebody one time or once a week is not going to cut it. It's just not.
No. Yeah. And I think, and I always want to point out to people, sometimes us addicts and alcoholics get under the impression that we're so unique and that we're the only ones that struggle with this stuff and we've got it so hard. And that's just not true. Life is hard for everyone. Relationships are hard for everyone. Parenting is hard for everyone. Building a business is hard for everyone. But if you want to make a major change, and I'm not saying everybody needs to do, these extreme level things, but if you are really raising your hand saying, I want to change my life, there's something deep down within me I can't put my finger on, and I'm totally committed to figuring out what that is, or why do I keep drinking even though my wife has said for the fourth time that she's out and that my kids don't want anything to do with me, or I'm on the verge of going back to jail, or whatever that thing must be. And you go, I'm willing to do anything. And then you call Angela for help. And she goes, okay, I want you to get up in the morning. I want you to journal and do some prayer meditation. If you believe in God, great. If you don't, I want you to meditate and journal. I want you to go to a meeting. I want you to call someone every day. I want you to, check in with me at this time. I want you, like, and then all of a sudden you go, what, Angela, that seems like a lot. Like, I'm not sure I'm willing to, can't we just meet once a week? I think the problem
so
with,
true.
Dude, I think the problem with once a week is, and again, I see a therapist. I see her once a week. I don't really think it's enough. Maybe it is enough because, again, what I shared earlier about doing this heavy lifting. But, like, even if the therapy session or the coaching session or the meeting is just amazing, the problem is you got too damn much time to talk yourself out of things. You got too much damn time for your subconscious thinking, which is the thinking that goes on whether you like it or not, which usually are developed, the habits that you have that you hate and you can't figure out why you can't do them, or the things that you end up doing that you're embarrassed and ashamed of. You got too much time in between those weekly appointments to justify not going, not working out, like whatever the case may be. And so for me, it's very difficult for me to halfway do anything. It's very difficult for me to eat well 3 days, 4 days a week. It's very difficult for me to just pray and meditate or just journal, even sometimes 5 days a week. Those two weekends that I go, it's a weekend, I'm going to sleep in, I don't have to. It's almost inevitable that I'm going to be off my routine six to eight weeks later. I do really well for a while and then I'm off the thing. And I even hate talking about the thought that I have to do something every day, 7 days a week, 365. just disgust. I just want to gouge my eyes out. But my life is, when I look at like my serenity, to feel happy, joyous, free, to feel elation, all the full range of emotions, when I do things 7 days a week, I tend to be able to feel better. When I don't, I lose the ability to feel all the full range of feelings, and my defects start spurting out the side. And then before you know it, I'm wondering why my wife is pissed off, why my kid is you know, acting a fool, why I can't work, why I feel so miserable. It's like, I just like to have, I really want to halfway do things, but it just doesn't work for me.
Well, we're not really wired. We're not really wired to do anything halfway. And as people with anxiety also, you know, we create rituals and routines because there is safety in knowing what you're going to do and what it's going to be like. When it's predictable, it's very comfortable, right?
Yeah.
And that's what your subconscious mind is all about. Your subconscious mind, your subconscious entire job in life is to keep you safe. And when you start to deviate from your habits and you start changing routines and you quit drinking, it feels very unsafe to your subconscious. So your subconscious starts talking you back into it. Mm-hmm. It wants you to go back to the other way because that's what feels safe. Like, don't rock the boat. And when we start making all these changes, it's rocking the boat. It's very unpredictable. We don't know what's going to happen. We're out of control and we are control freaks, right? And the whole thing feels uncomfortable.
Yeah. And I also think that's what's really interesting about that. And I've proven it over and over and over again, which is that I cannot outthink my subconscious. I cannot, willpower alone is not enough. One of the favorite analogies, Tony Robbins had said that willpower is kind of like a gas tank. You fill it up, you can will your way through a lot of stuff. And willpower is great and it can help you do a lot of amazing things. But when that willpower gas tank runs out, usually you resort back to that which you've been abstaining from. Mm-hmm. And what I was talking about earlier is that if you're trying to abstain from drugs and alcohol and, you know, sugar, if it's a food thing for you, or sexual behavior, whatever, if you're white knuckling it, that's what we're talking about, is willpower to use that. Whenever it runs out and you don't develop, you know, for me, it would be a relationship with the power grading yourself. If you don't develop a habit of telling on yourself to a community or a tribe every day on a regular basis, that when that willpower runs out, my subconscious is just going to kick in and I'm going to go do whatever it was that I was doing. And so that is why it's so important to develop these other things, these other tools, not just the knowledge, not just the book knowledge. I mean, I'm sure you could give someone a printout or a workbook to go, hey, here's how you stay sober. You read it and you're like, wow, I got it. But then you're like, damn, why in the hell is it so damn hard to do all those things? It seems so simple. But if I just rely on my own intellect, my own willpower, all the things I think I know, it's inevitable that I end up painting myself into a corner. And that is the place that I consistently say I don't want to be, but yet why do I keep ending up there? And that's because I'm looking for easier, softer ways. I'm looking for shortcuts. I already know that, Angela. Tell me something new. It can't, the solution, this is a good one. When I ended up in this place with COVID, desperate, right? Had nothing to do with drugs and alcohol, all about my thoughts, feelings, and emotions. My attitude was, Angela, you got to give me something new. It can't be the same thing that you would tell a newcomer. It's got to be something else, Angela. But finally, when I had enough, I'm like, 30 meetings in 30 days, right? 5 to 10 phone calls every day, prayer, meditation. And magically, all of a sudden, I start coming out of it.
Magically.
The solution today, 19 years sober, the solution for me today is the exact same thing for the person that's listening to this podcast for the first time that's trying to get sober. It's the same stuff.
So I was just having this conversation with a client. I think it was somebody who's in my 6-week program. And we were talking about We were talking about deep breathing. And this is something I talk about in the podcast all the time, because again, we are people with anxiety. One of the best ways to start coping with anxiety is when you feel yourself getting anxious, deep belly breaths, right? It's a whole thing. And when I talk about it, I always say it's science, people. I'm not making it up, right? This is just science. This is a proven thing. But she and I were talking about it. And I said, you know, it's frustrating to me sometimes because I feel like a lot of the tools we talk about are so simple that people want to overlook them and they think it's not enough. They're like, well, that can't be it. That can't be it. And I'm like, well, yeah, that's what I do every day. You know, they want to brush those things off because they are so simple and it's not magical. It is nothing huge and life-changing with instant gratification. It's delayed gratification. And you're right, willpower, just like motivation, those things are only going to sustain you for so long, right? And what do you have to have when you run out of willpower and you run out of motivation? You have to have dedication. And that's where that thing really comes in of, on the days that I don't want to journal, I will still do it because I am dedicated to doing the things that are good for me. I'm dedicated to doing the things that have gotten me to this place of being healthy and happy and maintaining sobriety, where it doesn't feel like a chore. Life doesn't feel like a chore. Sobriety doesn't feel like a chore, right? So of course I'm going to continue doing those things, but it's the dedication and the commitment to keep doing it even when you don't want to. That's emotional maturity. You know, it's being a grown up, but that's how you sustain any change you want to make.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing that is, here's why I think community, process, people, I need people, is so important to me, because everybody knows how to lose weight and to get fit, get healthy. Everyone knows how to stay sober or to get sober or to quit drinking. You just quit drinking. Number one, you don't pick up the drink. You don't pick up the drug. To get healthy, you work out more than you stuff in your face, you know? But yet, why is it that so many people struggle with working out, getting healthy, losing weight, getting sober, staying sober, being the man or woman that they envision them to be? Everybody already knows. You can read in a book and it's free. You don't have to pay anybody for anything. But yet the sauce, the secret sauce, which is why connecting in some variation of community, whether it's 12 steps, something like your private groups, both, either or whatever, is that if it was that easy, you wouldn't be asking for help. You would never reach out to the Addiction Unlimited podcast and go, hey, Angela, can you help me do this? You wouldn't do that because you'd already know. And so here's the other thing I was thinking about was, if I knew what I needed for me, I would not have to ask for help from anybody. I can help you with stuff. I can help other people with stuff. But when it comes to kind of helping myself, like sponsoring myself, I never do a great job. And that's because I'm like in it. You know, I'm working with you, or I'm helping you or helping them, or working with a sponsee, I can help them make better decisions because I'm not emotionally like attached. I'm looking from the outside in. I can help everyone else make better decisions, but for myself, I've got to have that too. I don't think that is just for 12-step recovery. That's for business. That's for marriages. That's for relationship. That's for everything. You know,
that's why I always tell my listeners, I have a coach for everything.
Yeah.
Like I can't see my way through because I'm in the middle of it. Right. You hire a coach because you want somebody that has the view looking down on your life and can see the roads of the maze and tell you which roads to take, right? For us ourselves, we're in the maze. Like, you can't see that big picture. So yeah, you have to have guidance. You have to have people that know more than you to teach you how to get better and how to get farther in that path. And to your point, what you were saying a few minutes ago, my coach, one of my coaches said to me last year, I just talked about this on another podcast too, about being teachable. And yeah. One thing I caught myself doing with one of my coaches last year is I was saying, I know.
Oh, let me finish it for you. I know that. I already know. Yeah, I know that.
and my coach said, well, that's really cool, Angela. I'm glad you know it. There's a huge difference between knowing and doing.
Yeah.
And I was like, Touché.
The other thing I was thinking of, I don't know if you've read this book, but part of this work that I've been doing, a couple of my therapists is around this, like, work around masculinity and archetypes and, you know, working through like what it means to be a man, you know, and embrace masculinity instead of it being this kind of negative thing that I've really struggled with. And I didn't realize it till, you know, I started doing this work. But this guy named Stephen Pressfield, he wrote The War of Art. Have you ever heard of that? And then his follow-up book was Turning Pro. And that he talks a lot about that in Turning Pro is, you know, the difference between an amateur and a professional. A professional shows up every day to work, whether they want to or not. They journal every day before whether they want to or not. They podcast every day. They write their book every day. They parent every day. An amateur quits. An amateur only works when they're inspired. An amateur, you know, so everything is about, are you an amateur or are you a pro? And those principles are so relevant for me because in a lot of ways, I am an amateur. I quit. I start things and don't finish. I do things 80 or 90% of the way. And then I go, oh, see, I proved I can do it. Now I'm not, or I know I want to do this big thing that is I'm inspired or that I know that I want to kind of do or be when I grow up, but it's too scary. So I'll go work on this over here. You know, funny how organizing your closet becomes interesting when you got to do something that, you know, is scary to do. And you're like, oh, I think I'll organize the closet.
Oh my gosh. This is another thing. One of my coaches called me out on last year when I was like making social media graphics or tweaking something on my website. Yeah. Right. Cause I love that stuff. And she's like, oh, yeah, yeah, that's a great idea. She goes, let me ask you something. Are those graphics actually paying your bills?
Oh, they look pretty and they're fun, aren't they?
Yeah, right? Because it's so fun to make them. But the truth is, I was so fearful of doing sales-oriented things because I don't like selling. Selling's not my thing. It's just not my thing, right? Yeah. So I would hide behind all of these other things. And it's like, that's really sweet and cute and everything. And that's endearing that you don't like to sell shit. But if you don't sell shit, then you don't have a business and you don't have a podcast and you don't have anyone to podcast to because they'll all go away.
That's right.
So and yeah, I think there's... you want to hide behind these other things. And it gets very, very tricky because sometimes those rationalizations to keep you from doing something, sometimes they're legit, right? Yeah. When the committee is saying, God, I'm so tired. Like, I really don't feel like logging on for a Zoom meeting tonight. Like, that's legit. That's very real. Yeah. And it's honest and it's true. You probably are tired. But like you said, when you're a pro, it's about dedication and commitment. It's not about if I want to or don't want to. It's not about does it feel good or does it not feel good. It's about this is what I do because this is the person I want to be.
Yeah. And I think what makes it can make it be very complicated is how, I guess this goes back to, for me, checking in with people on a regular basis that know me, that I give permission to give me feedback when I don't ask for it, or that I give permission, or I'm paying them money. Matt, isn't it funny, Angela, when you write someone big fat checks that's a little bit uncomfortable financially, that you happen to like listen to what the hell they tell you?
It's, you know, so true.
If I give it to you for free, you might not do it, you know, but it's got to be uncomfortable. Because the other thing, if it's too small money, I go, that's like going out to dinner. I'm not worried about it. But two things that I give you permission to tell me, whether it's with a sponsorship relationship or 12 step that's typically free, or it's a paid relationship where I'm paying you to listen, that I will justify not going to a meeting to under the umbrella of self-care. You know, Angela, I've been working really hard and I've just, you know, I just need to take care of myself. You know, I'm not going to go to a meeting. Well, if I tell you that, you'd be like, mofo, weren't you just telling me how miserable you were? Weren't you just telling me how much you wanted to? And I go, oh, that's right. And I log on to the meeting. But if I don't tell you, I'll go self-care. I'll post on Facebook, self-care tonight. Everybody's yeah, like, right. Yeah, you go, boy. You go, girl. Yeah. That's the difference between like me, like sponsoring and coaching myself and relying on right. someone that can kind of see outside. And I hate even using that term of like, call me on my BS, but that's really what it is.
Yeah,
like,
for sure. Because well, it's accountability. And this, I'll tell you yeah. what my sponsor got me on really early on. You know, I always drove sports cars and I live in a city now that has snow, right? So I say, my sponsor calls me one night and he's like, what are you doing? And I go, well, I was going to go to a meeting, but I don't really want to get my car out. And he goes, oh, wow. He goes, I didn't know that about you. So when it snowed, you wouldn't go drinking? Yeah. And I was like, oh, all right. I see your point right. there. I see what you're doing here. And but it was brilliant, you know, because I was yeah. like, oh, yeah, he's right. No, I would have always gotten the car out. Like, I would always go drinking regardless of anything.
This will always stick out in my mind. The way my sponsor got me to basically got rid of all my excuses about going to a meeting every single day. He would say, if there, and I like drugs, alcohol's great, but I really like drugs. And he goes, here's what you ask yourself. Would you go to the meeting if every time you showed up, there was free drugs there? And I would go, yeah, of course. He goes, well, if the answer is ever no, you don't have to go. I'm like, that's weird. The answer is never no. And he's like, exactly. Go to a meeting every day and shut up.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Okay, so how did you get out of your quarantine funk? Well, wait, first, what do you really think got you in the funk? Was it really just being disconnected from people?
I just think it was the perfect storm of, I was doing some big boy work that I'd never done before. You know, ACA, I'm very similar to you where I don't have a whole lot of, big T trauma for the listeners. Big T trauma would be like, you know, being, you know, sexually assaulted or being in a big car crash or combat. Your parents left. Yeah. Like that's big T trauma. Little T trauma is, you know, a lot of things that's coming up for me is listening to my parents argue in the other room and being a little boy and being scared. That simple. Right. Or, getting in trouble, doing something, and my mom got really pissed off. And in my little boy mind, the punishment didn't match the crime. In other words, like I didn't understand why she was so mad. What I didn't know at the time was, you know, being a mom of two kids, why your husband's gone a lot, or, you know, the financial challenges. And so when I dropped the milk or whatever, she would get mad, but it wasn't just about that. It was about everything else. And so that traumatized me, right? So when I flash back to those experiences, which I didn't know that I had, it was traumatic. And so working through going to ACA meetings, working with my therapist, because I was still meeting my therapist all this time, but it was not going to meetings. It was not calling and talking to people. Because here's the thing about talking to people. I don't know if you experience this as well, is sometimes calling people is for me, and sometimes calling people is for them, and sometimes calling people is for the both of us, and sometimes we just don't freaking know, right? Like, I think that, you know, I need to call people to make me feel better or to tell myself or whatever, but I never know when I reach out to someone, whether it's a call, a text, or, hey, I'm thinking about you. I don't know that they might be in a desperate situation and need to hear from me, right? And so I just missed that. It's not like when I was making all these phone calls, we were having these deep, moving, profound conversations every day. But like, they would say something and I'd go in my mind, I'm like, well, I guess my stuff's not that big of a deal. Or yeah, that, or I'd say something out loud and realize how stupid it sounds and I'd laugh it off, but it wouldn't build up. Right. You know, usually, you know how you kind of, I don't know about you, but I talk to myself and I'm not very kind. I say things like, oh, I'm such an idiot, or oh, I'm not very smart, or oh man, you can't finish and follow through. That's how I talk. But if I talk to you about that, I go, you know, that doesn't sound right. Let me change my verbiage, or, you know, whatever. So I think it was just the accumulation of things, not going to meetings, not talking to people on a consistent basis, not even going out of the house, girl. I wasn't going out of the house. So like everything was at home. Now, my wife and my in-laws who I live with, they loved it. They'd rather not see anybody anytime, you know? So, and then the pressure of having my 4-year-old son, he wasn't going to school, you know? So as soon as I got out of my office, which was the sewing room, it was not even an office, I had here's the other thing. I didn't realize how much I got from drive time, like the 45 minute drive home, or, you know, the time in between appointments. It's just like, anytime throughout the day, I walk out and I got a 4-year-old on my ankle, and it's like, all right, dad, you're on, you know? And I'm like, so it was just all of that. And I just didn't, you know, I don't know what I don't know. You know, it's like, if I could manage it all and didn't need any help, I wouldn't need outlets like this and things to listen to and meetings to go to. So it was just the accumulation of everything. And you know, for the first time in my life, even now, I've got more, you know, anxiety than I've ever had. And it's just a new thing to deal with. And I think I know too, from experience, is that I know it's temporary. Mm-hmm. And it's just important that I do things consistently for my mental health, my spiritual health, my emotional health, and ultimately my sobriety. Cause I don't like who I am when I feel restless, irritable, and discontent, you know? And here's the other thing that's interesting. This is how I try to manhandle and will my way into a right way of being and a right way of acting, is I stuff my feelings and I detach. And so what that looks like is I take all these big feelings that I think are insignificant and I just stuff them and they go down in my gut, and I got this uneasiness in my gut. Now, I don't tell anybody I feel that, but I got an uneasiness in my gut. And then I detach, which means when my wife needs support or my son falls and cries, I'm detached that I can't feel real empathy. I can pretend empathy. I can pretend compassion, but I can't really feel empathy and compassion with the people that are closest to me. And then on top of that, I have these outbursts. And so what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to wrestle joy and satisfaction out of life, right, with detachment and stuffing my feelings. And it's no wonder I'm not the man I want to be. It's no wonder I'm not the husband I want to be. It's no wonder I'm not the father. And it's no wonder all I want to do is numb and use and eat and be left alone, because I am trying to manage my emotions with this. You know, remember I told you how smart I am. I'm trying to think my way through things, Angela, and I end up just miserable and being someone that I'm embarrassed and ashamed to be. So.
Well, also, you can't, this is something I had to learn the hard way also. I can't fix my broken thinking with my broken thinking.
Yeah. It's like the blind leading the blind.
Absolutely. Again, it's the same thing. Like, I have to reach out to somebody that knows better, or who has done more, or who is farther along in the process. Like, I have to have somebody to guide me. I can't figure it out, especially when I'm in a low place.
I think the other thing that is we haven't really talked a ton about, but when we talk about, you know, one of the most important principles is the way we keep what we have is by giving it away. right? You keep what you have by giving it away. And even if you feel like a piece of crap, and even if you feel raw and emotional and like an absolute total loser, one way to get over that is to go help someone else. Like to go, it's like this idea of we have to act ourselves into a right way of thinking that was really big for me, is because everything I've been explaining to you is I've been trying to think myself into a new way of acting, but it does not work because my subconscious will kick in and I'll do what I always do, which is usually selfish, self-centered by nature, being driven by 100 forms of fear. But when it's like I used to do this when I was going to meetings where I'd work all day. I'd be like, you know, I'm tired. I don't really want to go to a meeting. But what I would do is I'd get in my car and I'd just start driving towards the meeting. I'm like, you know, I don't want to go to a meeting. There's nobody there. I can't help. I don't even want to hear Angela share again. I know she's going to share about that thing again. But I'm like going to the meeting and I pull up and I'm like kicking dirt and there's cigarette butts. I'm like, this place sucks. I can't believe I'm coming. This is stupid. And I sit in there and all of a sudden people start sharing. And before you know it, I'm like, you know, this ain't that bad. And by the end of it, I'm like, you know what? I'm so grateful I went to a meeting. Y'all go out for dinner?
Yeah.
So it's this idea of if I listen to my thinking, I would hang my hat on self-care and go home and Netflix and chill and do absolutely nothing and feel absolutely miserable, or at least just the same uneasy, grumpy son of a gun you hear right now. But if I would just get outside of myself, make those phone calls to people, hey, how's it going? What's going on? You know, go help that newcomer in the meeting, that I typically, more times than not, feel better. And at the minimum, I don't feel worse. And that is, again, going against my better judgment. Because at any given moment, I don't want to do anything, Angela. I don't want to help nobody. I don't want to be responsible. I want to quit. I want to Netflix and chill and leave me alone. But give me some food, too, and some ice cream.
I was just going to say, an ice cream. Yes.
Yeah, that's the if I ever wonder if I'm still an alcoholic, because I got sober a month after my 21st birthday, and there's plenty of people that go, are you sure you're an alcoholic? I mean, you could have just been young and dumb. All I got to do is look at my caffeine intake and my sugar intake, and I know for a fact that I am still, one is too many and a thousand is never enough. There's no question.
Like, listen, alcohol is like the least of my worries, okay? I overdo everything.
Everything. As I tell people, I will use anything to change the way I feel, even if it makes me feel worse. And you heard that correctly. Even if it makes me feel worse, just as long as I don't have to feel the way I feel right now. You know, because I think that's the other thing, Angela, is I think everybody else has it figured out. You've got your stuff together. If I could just feel inside the way you looked, I think it would be all good.
And
I try to fill that hole with anything and everything that I can get my hands on often, unless I'm doing the big boy work and I'm you know, more serene, I'm more balanced, and I'm less likely to have those like spurts, those things that squirt out the side. So anyway, basically this is a long conversation, Angela, of reminding myself of why I still got to do the same stuff I've been doing for 19 years. Because all this knowledge ain't got me nowhere.
Well, I hope you stick with it because it just gets better.
That's what they say, Angela. That's what they say. I'm not sure I believe them.
Well, I'm glad. I am glad you're sticking with it because it's supposed to be hard. It's not supposed to be easy. Life isn't easy, and it's one of the greatest challenges is just understanding that life being hard and being uncomfortable is not specific to addiction. It's not, I'm not uncomfortable because I'm a recovering alcoholic. I'm uncomfortable because I'm a human being living life, and life is a pain in the ass. That's all.
I think the other thing is when people talk about being grateful they're an alcoholic, being grateful they're a drug addict, that I think what they mean is they have a bit of a cheat code, or at least that's how I feel. I feel that I am so lucky that I've got this design for living that I kind of got a cheat code for people. You know, I'm in some of these groups and masterminds, and I'm dropping this stuff. They think I'm so smart. All I'm doing is regurgitating the stuff you just told me in the meeting.
Yeah, you know, so at I know. Least we I have... say that all the time. Like, I'll get all these emails. Oh my gosh, you helped me so much. And I'm like, oh, good. Because all of my greatest stuff I've learned from AA.
Yeah, jacked it all.
All and my best material came from the rooms of 12 steps.
And I'm telling, when I'm talking to you guys, I'm talking to me. Because I have to hear this stuff. Because if I don't say it, I'll be down the damn creek thinking I'm the bomb heading towards Niagara Falls or something.
So this is something I feel like people really don't understand, especially when you're a professional doing this work, right? People will say all the time, but people in 12 steps do it with sponsors. Like, I think you and I were talking about this earlier today, and people will say, like, I don't want to call. I don't want to bother you. I know you're busy.
Yeah.
I don't want to reach out. I know you've got a lot going on. And I feel like what they don't understand is I need those calls from people too.
Yeah.
You know, and I just had a moment in a private chat where one of the girls in the group started a private chat with some of us other girls in the group to just talk about girl things because there's boys in the rest of the group. So she pulled some of us into this private chat, and it was, I think it was a Friday night, and you know, it was later in the evening. Of course, I'm in bed cuddling my dog, probably watching terrible television because that's what I love. And I get this text, and we had this exchange just between us girls, and it was probably only 10 or 15 minutes. But when it was over, I had such an overwhelming feeling of gratitude that I got to be a part of that exchange, right? And that I was included and that I got to support someone else. Like, it was such a great thing. And I feel like people always think they're bothering or they don't want to waste your time. I know you're busy, but it's like, dude, I need those calls too. Like, I need people to reach out to me too. That's how my sobriety thrives also, is helping each other, you know?
Yeah. And I think if you could take away, you know, kind of a theme from our conversation is, I don't know what's best for me. At any given moment, most of the time, I need help making some of the even most basic decisions. And that also goes to, I don't know when I make that phone call, if it's going to be for me or if it's going to be for you. And I don't know if you, even if it's like, the amount of times that I've called someone 5 or 6 times, they didn't answer. I left them a voicemail. Hey, thinking about you. Drop them a text. No worries. Just thinking about you, making calls. And talk to them 3 months later. And they go, hey, those phone calls, thank you so much for thinking about me. I was in a dark place and I could. And here I am. I'm liable to get upset with them. They're not calling me back. Or this idea that this is kind of the same thing with like self-care, this, you know, this umbrella, how we can make being worried that we might interrupt someone look really good. Like, it does sound nice, doesn't it? To go,
yeah, consider,
I don't really want to bother them. But that's also an example of, number one, I think I'm so powerful, like I'm going to interrupt their day. This is what I tell people is, call me. If I can answer, I'll answer. And if
that's exactly what I said.
If I can't answer and I'm busy, I won't answer. So call me. And then I get the, hey, are you busy? I'm like, this is usually with sponsees that can be a little bit, you know, rougher, but they go, hey, are you busy? I'm like, did I ask you to text and ask if I'm busy, or did I ask you to make a phone call? And so that's what I need a lot of times, because again, left to my own thinking, I'll go, oh, they must be busy, or I don't want to bother them. And I would always come back to whoever's helping me, which is, well, did you ask me how to stay sober? Did you ask me how to build community? Did you ask me how to get over this hump, you know, that you are in? So you pick up the phone and you make 5 phone calls a day, and you don't worry if they're busy. And if they answer, fine. It has nothing to do with you. And so that's just been, I think it's a, it could be an excuse. It could be a whatever. Oftentimes it has something to do with some sort of defect that I got going on. But I just think that going back to this idea of the way I made meeting making meetings a habit is going whether I wanted to or not. Yeah. And the way that I get comfortable with making phone calls and connecting with people and checking in and saying, hey, Angela, just thinking about you, is by doing it, even though it's uncomfortable. Because it's uncomfortable for someone not to answer or to say I'm busy. I might take it personally. I'm like, oh, my God, she didn't answer. It's the third time. Or, oh, she's busy. I feel bad. It's, you know, I feel bad about myself, you know, making what you being busy about me. It's complicated. So if we keep it simple, like make 5 phone calls a day whenever you think about it, it was like that's how I got over that hump. And now making phone calls is nothing except when COVID happens and then I forget and, you know, get all discombobulated and end up in therapy, depressed, on the verge of going into a psych ward.
It's a glamorous life.
No, it's glamorous, all right. So many people look at me, my family, my, you know, large circle of friends that aren't in recovery, they look at me like, you create so much crap for yourself. Why do you keep going through that? Why are you going through your childhood? Why are you still seeing a therapist? That sounds miserable. And I'm going, it's too late now. I can't stop. Once you know, you can't not know anymore.
That's right.
Anyway.
Well, Preston, thank you so much for coming on and having this conversation with me. I so appreciate it. I love when we can share all this good, raw, not so glamorous side of life and just being honest, you know, because just because you've been sober a long time doesn't mean you've got it all figured out. It doesn't mean that my life doesn't get complicated. It doesn't mean that there aren't days that I don't want to go hide under my bed and never come out. You know, I mean,
yeah,
it's part of being human. It's not specific to recovery. So I appreciate your candor and honesty.
Absolutely. And thanks for having me on, and I appreciate your service and what you do. And, you know, and if you're new and you're struggling and you're not sure where to go, whether it's you're trying to get sober or you're trying to stay sober, everybody's going through the same stuff. And when I keep it simple, when I ask for help, when I show up and help others, when I do what I'm asked to do, when I'm a pro instead of an amateur, and I stick with it, whether I'm inspired to or not, more often than not, I end up 10 times better than I could ever imagine. And it's a good place to be. As much as I, you know, maybe complain or make it sound uncomfortable, it is uncomfortable. But, you know, where I would have been if I didn't end up being forced down this path, because I was forced down this path, I God knows where I'd be. Thanks for having me on, Angela, and thanks for your service.
Thank you. I almost stopped recording, but I remembered I can't stop recording because now we have to do the second part.
Nice. What'd you think? Was that like the best episode ever, Angela? The best?
Obviously.
Come on, tell me how good I did so I don't feel insecure.
Do you feel insecure?
Every time I do something, I'm always so excited. My wife goes, how'd it go? I'm like, I guess it's all right. Just another thing. And then I'm like, I always end up going,
I'm always like, maybe I think it was okay. That's probably okay.
Here's the other thing is, you know, a lot of things that I think is so amazing, like kind of sucks. And then thing that I think we're like, I get, you know, good feedback on.
Or people no go, question. Oh, God, that was so like, that's why I don't worry about it too much, because the truth is, it's not every episode is not going to resonate with every person. Right. Yeah. And I used to also get really weird about repeating so many things, but people freaking love it. Like I can't,
same shit.
Like I feel like I'm just saying the same things over and over on every episode, but it's like, sometimes it takes people 4 or 5 times of hearing something before it really strikes, you know,
400 or 500 times.
Yeah. That's what right.
Gary V talks about. He said some of the feedback he gets is, dude, you just keep saying the same thing over and over again. He goes, exactly. So go do it. And I listen to him over and over again. My mother-in-law's like, why do you listen to him? He just says the same thing over and over again. I'm like, I don't know. I'd still need to hear it because I'm still not doing that shit. I'm a fast forgetter, Angela. I got to hear it over and over again.
I love the fast forgetter line. I'm going to start using that. So, we just finished recording the podcast. Now we are in the Sober Society VIP lounge.
That's I feel so important. So important.
As Trisha Lewis said, there is no champagne in this VIP lounge.
Maybe we'll have some bubbly, can you get some seltzer water or something? one of those Zevia root beers.
Okay, here's what I want to know. Here's what our Sober Society VIP lounge talk is going to be. What are your top five rituals that keep you sober?
This is easy. I think they tell you this when you first come in the rooms, and it is like I told you before.
We're going to adapt it also to not being in the rooms, because a lot of my people are not 12 steppers. So we're going to adapt it to non 12 steppers too.
Yes, I can do that. So first, here, when I am most serene and I am most emotionally sober, it has nothing to do with drugs and alcohol, emotionally sober, is I get up in the morning right away and I pray, meditate. Lately I've been doing some breathing exercises, but pray and meditate. If you don't believe in a God or higher power, it's just like taking that quiet time to be able to center. It's always usually with that is reading some sort of personal development, recovery literature, something that I, for me, it's usually nonfiction or some spiritual in nature to kind of set me in a direction or at least a theme for the day. I make a couple of phone calls. So it says three. So I make a couple of phone calls throughout the day, usually about five, maybe more, maybe less. So try to talk to someone that's like either a mentor. They don't necessarily have to be in recovery, but someone that's on a path that's a positive influence on me. I will, if it's a meeting day, I'll go to a meeting. So that would also be, I get a lot out of checking in with multiple people. That's kind of, you know, can represent a bit of a gathering, place. And then at the end, doing some sort of gratitude, whether it's praying and meditating or a gratitude list, those were foundational, principles or things that I developed long ago, and they're still applicable today. And when I don't do them, Angela, I'm just not as content. I'm just not as, it's not happy, because it's not like I feel terrible when I don't, but
right,
you know, something's off when I don't do that.
Yeah, you definitely don't have the same. I know for me, gratitude was absolutely a life-changing thing when I really figured out gratitude. And it sounds so simple, like, of course, be grateful. Okay, cool. But yeah. I did a 30-day gratitude exercise about 6 years ago now. And it was one of the best experiences, because it opened my eyes to all these other things about gratitude and all these different things that I would have never thought to have gratitude for. It was incredible. It was really, really good.
I think that goes along the lines of what we were talking about earlier, is most of the path to happiness is usually basic, simple steps. It's basic principles. There's not a personal development person that you can look up right now that doesn't talk about gratitude.
Yes.
But there's a difference between actually physically doing a gratitude list consistently over a period of time and actually knowing that I should be grateful, or thinking a few gratitude, you know, thinking about a few grateful things when it's convenient. I think the other thing, Angela, that was really important for me and has been in my journey is remembering that understanding comes after I do the work, right? Whether it's a 30-day gratitude list, whether it's a four-step, whether it's a, you know, I want you to do these five things every day for the next 90 days. if I usually what I'll do, Angela, is I want to say like, hey, well, just to, you know, like, why am I doing this? Like, tell me what I'm going to get out of it. That's like getting paid before you do the work. You ever done a job that you got paid first versus doing a job and you're going to get paid after? My instinct is, if you're anything like me, I do a much better job when I get paid after.
Yeah.
If I get paid up front, you know, I'm like, I don't need to do that thing over there in the corner, and that's tight enough, I think.
Definitely, yes.
So the understanding comes after we do the work. And quite frankly, when I give people recommendations, or when I have a mentor or someone guiding me, gives me a task or an assignment, they don't even know what I'm going to get out of it, you know? It's, but I have to do the work in order to figure out what the payment is at the end. And so, yeah,
so true.
So yeah, that's regardless of what that is, that's one of those, it sounds just so simple, just like losing weight, you know, oh, eat less and work out. Well, that's simple. Come on, Angela, give me the secret. Well,
yeah.
The secret is you actually have to do it.
I'm telling you, it's so true. Like, so many of the tools that we talk about, it's like people just want to blow it off because it's not profound, you know, because it is, it's just everyday simple life things. But that's how you change your life, is in micro decisions. It's thousands of micro decisions that get you to the big moments, you know?
I think the other thing that I can fall into is the I knows, which we talked a little bit about that before, is because if you go, oh, make a gratitude list for the next year. Oh yeah, Angela, I know that. I know that works. Yeah. But I won't do it. I did it 6 years ago. I know it's a good idea, but I already did that, Angela. I already did that thing. I read that book, Angela. I don't need to do that.
Yep.
And it's like this. That's why I need to hear the same thing over and over again and do the same thing over and over again. Because it still works. And left to my own devices, I'll think myself right out of serenity or right out of the rooms or right out of whatever. And so, yeah, simple stuff and accountability works really well for me.
That is perfect. I hope that you really enjoyed your time in the VIP lounge.
That was legit. Next time I need a Zevia root beer. That's what I like. Zevia root beer.
And a swag bag, huh?
Swag bag, yes. Preferably a watch. Yeah.
Oh, nice. Wow. I mean, or a pair of shoes,
K-Swiss or watch, something like that. All right, Angela, write it down. Because remember, I told you how VIP, how important I think I am.
Yeah, I know. You are important. Mm. Thank you, Preston.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You've reached the end of another great episode of the Addiction Unlimited podcast. Candid and honest conversation about addiction and recovery. Be sure to visit us at addictionunlimited.com to join the conversation and access show notes and links to everything we talked about. Love this episode? Please take 30 seconds to subscribe, rate, and review on iTunes to help us improve and give you the information you want. Thanks for listening. See you next week.